This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Hamilton County rolls out its list of top infrastructure projects. A dispute with the Department of Housing and Urban Development could displace dozens of tenants at the Alms Hill Apartments. And Music Hall reopens this weekend after a major renovation. We'll discuss these stories and more for our weekly review of local news. And joining us first, our WCPO.com politics and government reporter Paula Christian, Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Cameron Knight, WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. And you can join us 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Paula, Cameron, Howard, and Jay, good to see everybody this afternoon. Thank you for being here.
Good afternoon.
Jay, let's start with, by talking about Mayor Cranley's State of the City speech, which he gave on Tuesday. What were the key points you got out of that?
It was probably more like a review of the last 4 years. He started out talking about economic development, talking about the new Kroger grocery store downtown, the major expansion at Children's Hospital Medical Center in Avondale, talked about public safety, talked about the opioid crisis, neighborhood development. Really not a whole lot of new initiatives. The only thing that was new was he's asking each city resident to the program is called Give One for Cincy, and basically the idea is that each person he's asking once a month they give an hour to some way support something in the city, such as mentoring or teaching folks to read or helping at a food bank or something like that.
I understand he gave a shout-out to the local brewing industry.
Yeah, that was probably the one that got the most attention. He did say, and he even laughed about it, beer is bringing back our neighborhoods, and he highlighted a number of local breweries, and there was actually a video put together that they showed during the as part of the speech about these local breweries.
And Howard, what's your takeaway from this speech the other night?
Well, I thought it was interesting. I agree with Jay that he didn't say much that was new in terms of new initiatives, new programs, new plans, that sort of thing. He's an incumbent running for reelection against Yvette Simpson, who is pretty aggressive, and I think he's, you know, where 4 years ago when he was sort of started out as the underdog against Roxanne Qualls, everybody thought she was going to win that thing originally. He was on the offense, and this time around, I think he's on the defense. He's playing a defensive game. And when you're playing defense, you don't go out and do bold strokes. You try to keep the ship right, and you start talking about what you've done, what you've accomplished over the last 4 years. I think that's what he's doing.
Yeah. Cameron.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there were a lot of really interesting points they brought up, but again, I mean, he talked about his the Office of Analytics. He talked about the different heroin initiatives to fight the opioid epidemic. You know, it was kind of a highlight reel of some of the best things that he accomplished, and yeah, the beer thing. I mean, he tried to keep it light, and also at these State of the City addresses, he gives out awards. He tries to recognize other council members. I mean, I think nearly every council member was recognized in some way for some accomplishment that they received. So, and it's important to note that this is the only speech he gives that's mandated by the city charter. He has to give this speech every year, and so there is some tradition and some things that he tries to that are kind of always a part of this speech. So the awards for Cincinnati End of the Year, the different humanitarian things that he tries to spread the praise around a little bit.
If you've listened to some of his debates, the phrases that he used in the State of the City are very similar. City's moving in the right direction. City's moving in the right direction. Like, that is his whole theme of the campaign. And then when I heard this speech, to me, it sounded like a campaign speech.
Mm-hmm. There was some talk that, you know, perhaps this was, you know, oh, look, the mayor is giving the State of the City address less or about a month before the election. Mm-hmm. But this is the time of year when Cranley has chosen to give these speeches. I look back, I think one of them.
It's always been in the fall.
It's always been in the fall.
Yeah.
One, I think, was the earliest, I think, was maybe mid-September. Mm-hmm. But normally it's around the first or second week of October.
Yeah, and I think Cam's right. I mean, it's it's a duty of the mayor to deliver this speech every year, and it becomes more of a ceremonial thing than it does a substantial thing.
Yeah. And the same people go every year.
Every year.
Every year it's the same people.
Has been ever since the dawn of time. And it's, you know, it's more of a ceremonial type speech. It's not, it is not designed to be a campaign speech.
And I mean, if you saw the, and the crowd that was there was obviously big supporters of him, and he knew he was, he was met with raucous applause when he came out on stage. You know, if it's a campaign event at all, it might be appealing to his base a little bit, but yeah, I mean, there
it
is
makes
a,
good visuals for him. And
there is a, yeah, there's, but there is definitely kind of a ceremonial aspect.
But I do think in speeches in the years past, he's been much more honest about some things he'd like to fix going forward, some problems that the city has that maybe are continuing, and hasn't done as well as he could have. This year, I feel like the speech was absent of all of that. It was everything that was good and nothing forward-looking.
Yeah, did he, in the speech, Paula, didn't he promise to increase the city's efforts to fight climate change, and also talked about, reiterated his support for reducing childhood poverty in Cincinnati?
Yes, absolutely. Well.
But again, but to the point that those are nothing new.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And those are all things everybody can agree on. I mean, you know, reducing childhood poverty, yes, of course.
That's been on his agenda for 4 years.
It has been, and it, you know, nobody can disagree with that. If you can have thousands of fewer children in this city living in poverty, then that's good. So, you know, it, what he's avoiding is the kind of more controversial type issues that are going to, you know, cause a stir in a campaign, in the middle of a campaign, and he doesn't want that at this point. He wants to be able to go to the debates, make his points, take a few shots at her for you know, things like the Children's Hospital expansion project, and then, you know, move on.
Did Yvette Simpson release any statement or have any comment?
No, and Yvette was not at the – she had a prior commitment, I think. I believe they said something with her law school, and it was like an alumni anniversary, so she wasn't there. And I specifically asked on Monday and asked again Tuesday for some sort of response, and they said that there wasn't going to be one.
We did the same thing.
Which I'm wondering if that was a missed opportunity.
Could be a missed opportunity, but, you know, it's not, you know, why get into it over that? You're going to have, you know, so X number of debates between now and November 7th where they are going to engage head-to-head on the issues.
But she does need the media attention.
Oh, yeah, she needs it.
Cranley gets so much of it just by the nature of everything he does every day.
Right.
He's on TV. He gets as much press as he wants to all day long. She has to fight so much harder for it. I think if she had given a response to the state of the city, even if it was congratulating something, it is media time. It is FaceTime. It is putting her out there. I would have released something.
I think I would have too. But I certainly wouldn't have told reporters Well, maybe we'll get something out tomorrow.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't work that way.
You
know, by that time, it's over.
Story's gone.
Yeah. We've all moved on to something else.
Yeah, I think Yvette has sort of taken the stance that she is going to run a ground game.
Yeah.
And it's I think that her focus is probably less on the media and more on just grinding away in the neighborhoods.
But I went door to door with both of them. And everybody recognizes John Cranley. Not as many people recognize Yvette Simpson. And I think that is one of her core struggles, is the recognition with people who don't know her. And I just think that she's got to capitalize on that going forward.
Well, Cincinnati politics have certainly been very interesting this year, Howard. And
no.
Yeah.
But I think you're leading into something that Howard and I want to talk about.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
Because it's going to get even better, isn't it? It could get even better in the next few years.
Well, it could. You know, we have a situation now where in the city council race, you have three open seats. And you have six incumbents running all of whom, if they are reelected, and that's not a lead pipe cinch, that's not mm-hmm. by any means certain, but if they did all six get elected and they served out their terms, you can end up with six open seats 4 years from now. And we'd get into the cycle of 3-6, 3-6, 3-6 every 4 years because of this new system, which makes
System was voted in 2012.
In November of 2012, it was voted in with 51% of the vote. It was a charter amendment. It was placed on the ballot by city council at the urging of Lori Quinlivan and others, obviously. And it passed, but it talked about four-year terms, but for all nine council members at once. A whole lot of people were saying, wait a minute, why don't we stagger this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why don't we do four in 1 year, and then 2 years later we come back and do the other five?
Well, you want the simple answer to why that didn't happen? Hmm? Because nobody wanted to be four, and nobody wanted to be five.
Yeah.
That's where it broke down to. It was one or the other, and they chose to be all nine.
Right. But still, this system absolutely makes no sense whatsoever to do every 4 years all nine in a field race, because you are going to end up with, you know, very large numbers of open seats, and it's just going to be a rugby scrum.
Cities don't do it that way.
No, they don't.
Well, and along with that,
it's not common at all.
If the council, if Howard's right, if the six incumbents are reelected, as long as they serve through the end of June of 2019, I believe, they can step down, and the remainder of their term would be filled out by someone else. So it may be unlikely, but it is possible that by the time voters go to the polls in 2021, the six incumbents that are there now will not be the six incumbents mm-hmm. who are running for reelection in 2021.
Right. And some of them will be gone, yes.
And probably, it's unlikely that all six would leave early, but I would say probably three or four potentially could leave early. And those people who are appointed to seats, term limits doesn't apply to them, so they literally could serve. If they were to get elected two more terms after that, they could literally serve for 10 years as opposed to 8 years.
Yeah, if they're appointed halfway through the next term.
And another little election quirk, if anyone were to resign between the beginning of 2018 and the end of June of 2019, if they're appointed to council, there's a special election. But then those years don't count either.
Right.
So
now, wouldn't that be fun? One council seat up and 20 people running for it?
And it would be a wide open field election race for one seat.
Talk right. about bedlam. Yeah, does this go under the unintended consequences file?
I think
probably.
It does, probably. I mean, it was discussed at the time when this thing was going through council and being placed on the ballot, and it was discussed. And I think that there were a whole lot of people in the city who were just saying, wait, you know, let's think this through. Let's talk about staggered terms some more. We don't have to do this immediately. But council decided to put it on the ballot, and the voters passed it. And the irony of it was that Lori Quinlivan, who was the creator of it,
came in 10th.
Yeah, lost the election, came in 10th, and just, you know, missed getting reelected year.
But part of it, too, though.
But now she's a candidate again, of course.
Howard clearly goes back longer than I do, but I can remember back in the 1990s when they were arguing about proportional representation, and that, mm-hmm. that's continued. And it seems like there's always these ideas. There's some groups that are never happy with the way the council and mayor are elected, but they never really can get together on a single plan that everyone can support. So, and that's why you end up with the piecemeal, okay, well, we're going to do 4 year terms, but it's going to be all nine seats instead of five and then four. Or let's do districts, let's do proportional representation, let's do strong mayor, executive mayor, and they just can't come together around a single plan. So then what happens is the charter is amended, but it's in a piecemeal
So are you saying that we could see another system pop up because they figure out this one's not quite going to...
Well, I think eventually you will. I mean, that's the history of charter government in Cincinnati. They keep changing it. They keep, you know, refining it. They keep moving things around. I mean, in the years I've been here, we've had three different ways of choosing a mayor. You know, we've had where the mayor was chosen by council itself. Mayor had absolutely no power whatsoever, could cut ribbons and issue proclamations. You had the top vote getter system, where the top vote getter in the city council election became the mayor. That was just a riot because that just turned council into this crazed body where everybody was trying to climb over each other to become the top vote getter. And then in 2001, we began this system, direct election of the mayor, with some authority some powers that the mayor had never had before, or not since the charter came into effect.
So lost in all this is the fact that we have a school board race, too, going on.
Yes, we do.
And it's a pretty busy one, isn't it? We've got a lot of candidates.
Yeah, there are 13 candidates for four seats, four of the seven seats. Obviously, there's a separate process that's going on now because Chris Elms passed away last month. And now the board itself is going to choose his replacement. But then the four seats on school board, because Mr. Nelms was not up for re-election this year. Those are all up for election this year, and you've got 13 candidates out there, you know, trying to get attention. It's very difficult to bust through and get attention to those kind of races in a mayoral election year and a city council election year, because those two races just drown out everything else. And it's very hard to get your message through, even though the schools obviously are a very important thing. And we have a whole lot riding on the future of the Cincinnati public schools.
Yeah. Jay and Howard, before we wrap this segment up, any final thoughts on this election season in Cincinnati?
I was just going to say, Howard didn't say it, but I'll say it for him. His column Sunday is going to be about the idea of Lookout 2021.
2021 could be something else.
Yeah, it's a little theoretical thing, and it's, you know, take a look at it Sunday morning.
Okay, so
at WVXU.org.
It's a could happen, not a will happen.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Well, Jay and Howard, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. We'll have more of our news review right after this. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, along with WCPO.com politics and government reporter Paula Christian, Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Cameron Knight, and joining us now, WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter if you have a question or comment. Paula, I always want to do that, make your name Christian.
Everybody
I don't know
does
why.
That. Don't feel bad.
Oh, it's not me? Okay,
no,
it's not just me.
No, everybody does. I don't even correct people anymore.
And Bill, good to see you this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, let's start by talking about a story that you covered this week. Hamilton County Commission President Todd Portune has identified four infrastructure priorities. So what's on his list?
Well, this goes back a couple of weeks. For a while, there's been talk about, you know, the county should help pay for a new soccer stadium. And Todd Portune has said, well, yeah, that's great. It's a great idea, but we've got all these other big projects we need to pay for. Last week, there was a public hearing from commissioners up at the election board's office in Norwood, and a number of soccer supporters turned up and said, yes, we build a stadium. And, well, commissioners heard that, and they heard discussion about other big box projects. Basically, on Monday at the commission meeting, Todd Portune says, look, after this public hearing, I've identified four big box projects that we can probably make some kind of move on in the next 60 days. For instance, the Western Hills Viaduct. We can apply for some federal money to help build that. We can do this. We can do that. We can make some moves to expanding the Sharonville Convention Center. We can apply for a Tiger grant to deck Fort Washington Way. That would be $25 million if they get it. That would pay for one section of Fort Washington Way to be covered. And the idea is to build on that, use the revenue generated from that, kind of the bank's model, to pay for the next section that would be decked. And, of course, you know, that would take a very long time to do, but it's one way of doing it. And then, of course, there's the soccer stadium, and commissioners have said, we like the idea, we'd like to help you, but we really don't have the money. And so this Monday, there's going to be another public hearing at 11 o'clock at the commissioner's office where they're going to talk about these four specific projects.
And is it likely more FC Cincinnati fans will show up at that meeting?
It's possible, although it's daytime. It's Monday morning, so they may not be available. They may not be able to get there from work. I think there was such a big turnout at the public hearing last week because it was in the evening.
Yeah, and now this particular list he's come up with, this is not set in stone yet. This is just the starting point.
These are just things that can be or have to be acted on in the next 60 days. For instance, the Tiger grant, applications for that federal grant are due October 16th. So if the county is going to apply for that money, they've got to get a move on.
Yeah, and same thing with MLS. I think MLS has a deadline, and that's one of the things that is driving the whole soccer stadium debate.
Yes.
I think it's
they've got to choose before the – well, the league is expected to choose two teams to expand into the major leagues before the end of the year. And let's see. Yeah, there is a deadline coming up, and that's something.
And that's why the 60 days that he's put out there, but nothing definite with this yet. Still, just kind of this is my suggested list.
Yes, these are the things that we should look at.
What does everybody else think on this?
Yeah. What does everybody else think on this?
Yeah.
Well, I think.
Have we heard from the other commissioners?
Chris Monzel has been characteristically quiet. I'm not sure he's a big. I don't know that he's in favor of spending a lot of money on building a soccer stadium. On the other projects, I think he is cautious about the Western Hills Viaduct plan to help pay for that by enacting a $5 auto licensing fee that the state says the county can do. And the decking, I'm not sure which way he goes on that, or the Sharonville Convention Center. Denise Driehaus, she hasn't really made a whole lot of noise on any of these either, but I think a lot of her views would probably echo Todd Portune's.
Yeah, and also there's the possibility that the levy schedule could be changed.
Yes. That was another discussion at the commissioner's meeting on Monday. The Cincinnati Zoo levy comes up for renewal next year, and instead of putting it on the ballot in November, they're considering moving that to the May primary ballot. What they're overall looking to do is to kind of spread out some of these levies so we don't have three on the ballot at once, because the idea is voters, property owners will look at that and say, oh, I can't afford all of these, and there's a fear that people will just vote all of them down if there's too many on a ballot at once. So they're talking about spreading them out, putting some in the spring, you know, maybe one every
so
time.
Doing it on a staggered basis.
Every time you go to the polls, there'd be one up for renewal. But that's still a lot. It's still early.
Yeah. Speaking of levies, Cameron, the Council on Aging, which could see its funding go up 37% if the senior services levy passes next month. Hamilton County Commission President Todd Portune asked the Council on Aging to consider adding several new programs. I think it was a total of three. And we now know what their response is to that.
Right. So basically, it's these programs were pitched by different organizations to be on the indigent care levy and to be kind of wrapped into that. Todd Portune kind of when he announced this increase that he's going to put on the ballot to the senior services levy, he also asked that three of these programs be moved over: a nurses program, a health initiative university or a health university program, which was pitched by the Health Gap, which is Dwight Tillery's organization that's has had some controversy recently, or mostly last year, when the Inquirer did some investigations into their organization's spending. And then the last program was a homeless respite care program. And basically, when the commissioners say, we want you to consider these programs, there's a couple things that they have to do. First, they have to consider whether the programs are going to benefit seniors. Obviously, they were initially pitched as indigent care, which is for homeless people. And then they also have to figure out if there's a need. And the programs wouldn't just be swept into the Council on Aging. It's the idea of the program that's actually being pitched. And then if they like the idea, they're going to competitively bid, have a competitive bidding process where they say, okay, we're going to see who wants to provide this service. The Council on Aging came back and said that they were not going to enter a bidding process for two of the programs. The Health University program, where they're trying to help people. The idea of the program was to help people navigate the healthcare system more easily, obviously for seniors, to help navigate the program more easily. And they were also not going to do a bidding process for the visiting nurses program. For the nurses program, they said, we already use this organization occasionally when we need it. They bid on things occasionally with us, and we use them and contract with them as needed. For the health, the program that was pitched by the Health Gap, the university program, they said that those needs were already being met by other services. There's a thing called the Health Collaborative, which just got a big grant. And then there was another program that they use called Fast Track, which is a program that kind of does that same access type stuff that the university would do. Basically, the thing is they came out with these two changes to the senior services levy. They said we're going to put an increase on the ballot, and we want these new programs to be added. Now the Council on Aging has come back and said there's still going to be an increase on the ballot, but we're only going to try to fold in one program to our budget, and that's going to be this homeless respite care program.
Mm-hmm. And the senior services levy is on the ballot in November, right?
The senior services levy is on the ballot in November, along with two other levies, the mental health levy and then the indigent care levy that I mentioned earlier. But both the mental health levy and the indigent care levy are being the voters are being asked to renew those at their current rates. There's not going to be any change to the amount of money that's that taxpayers pay toward those levies if they pass.
Now, Paula, there's a dispute involving the Department of Housing and Urban Development and the Alms Hill apartment complex in Walnut Hills, and it's ended up in federal court.
It has.
What's the situation here? What's the story?
Well, it's a very sad story. The Alms is a 200-unit apartment complex in Walnut Hills. It's primarily the people who live there are 98% African American. Many are disabled. Many are elderly. It has a Section 8 voucher with HUD, and HUD at the end of the summer said, we're canceling the voucher, and everyone else will give them a different kind of voucher where they can go move to a different Section 8 property or a different low-income property. And the residents were very upset about this. They don't want to leave their apartment complex.
And HUD's canceling because of conditions.
Because of the conditions. Yes, conditions. They're saying the conditions are awful. And I've seen the Alms has failed four inspections in the last 2 years, including a most recent inspection less than a month ago, just in September, where I've seen the photos and they're not good. I mean, there's roaches, there's broken, cracked walls, and there's outlets that are exposed, and it doesn't look good. But from the residents' perspective, it's better than it has been in years. And it is under a court-appointed receiver who is making repairs, and it is getting better. But from HUD's perspective, they've had years, and it still looks bad, and they're just kind of done.
And how many people are we talking about could be displaced by this?
There's 118 families.
Okay.
And, you know, what exacerbates the problem is that Hamilton County has a shortage of 40,000 low-income housing units already. So you know, the Greater Cincinnati Homeless Coalition is concerned that these families could become homeless. Because just because they get a different kind of a voucher, you still have to have a landlord that takes it. And there's not many landlords that will accept these vouchers. And they HUD can't force the landlord to take these people. And they could also, these other places they could live would maybe not be in Walnut Hills, not on a bus line, not close to their schools, not close to their employment. So the residents are really in a difficult situation. So they filed the lawsuit. HUD filed a response. The city of Cincinnati actually got involved this week as well. They filed what's called an amicus brief. So they're a friend of the court.
Friend
so
of the court brief.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're siding with the residents, saying we don't want the ALMS shut down because A, it's going to be a vacant building in Walnut Hills that the city's going to be responsible for patrolling.
That's a lot of people to try to find new homes
exactly.
for.
Exactly. And yeah. they're concerned these people will be homeless. So the judge heard the arguments today. And the decision is expected next week.
So what the residents are asking for is what, a preliminary injunction?
They want an injunction that would stop HUD from terminating their Section 8 contract. And while the case works its way through the court system, and they want HUD to come up with a different way to bring this building into compliance, basically give them time to come to the terms where they should be, instead of just ending the contract. But HUD, in its defense, is saying, look, this has national implications for us, because if you aren't going to create a living facility that is not, you know, dirty and unkept, what is that like for all of our other buildings across the country? They're creating a loophole that then other landlords could walk through and say, well, wait a minute, I don't have to keep my building up because the tenants don't want to leave and there's nowhere for them to go.
Who owns the ALMS right now? Who owns that?
That is privately owned.
Okay.
It is owned by PF Holdings. They own 5 apartment complexes in Cincinnati. The owner wants to sell all 5. The city would like, and HUD would like, the ALMS sold separately quickly. And it's actually found 2 buyers that want to buy it quickly, but the owner wants to sell it all as a group, and they want to maybe do it next year. So that's part of the conflict, too, is what the owner wants to do, what HUD wants them to do, what the city wants them to do. Then you have the residents, you have legal aid, you have the homeless coalition. It is just a situation with a lot of people that have a stake in what happens.
And once the judge rules next week, is that the end of it, Paul, or is there more yet to come?
There will be more. I mean, that he's going to rule on the preliminary injunction, so that doesn't end the case. It just puts a hold on essentially relocating people until the case is resolved. And then, you know, if the residents ultimately aren't happy, if they don't get the injunction or things don't go their way, they can appeal it.
Now, Cameron, on Wednesday, the move to change Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day came up before Cincinnati City Council again. I think this is, what, the second time in recent
yes.
years they've heard this issue?
Yeah. So, well, last year there was a motion, there was a proclamation proposed by Councilwoman Yvette Simpson, and she put it before council. There were many, many speakers there again, and at that time, and it just didn't pass. 4 people voted for it, and the rest of the council abstained. Mm-hmm. And at the time, based on our reporting that we did at the time, it was a kind of a stunning scene at City Council that day, because I feel like the people they thought it would pass. This year, there was no proclamation, there was no resolution, no motion.
It wasn't even on the agenda, right?
On the agenda, but and it had kind of been building up to this. There had been people coming before council here and there, just to kind of bring up the issue, just one speaker now and then for the past month or so. But on Wednesday, they showed up in force. There were probably 24 people there, at least 12 speakers. They spoke continuously for over an hour. There was maybe 1 or 2 people who wanted to keep Columbus Day, but the vast majority of the speakers were for it. And they were upset. They wanted the name of the the day changed to Indigenous Peoples Day to recognize recognize the Native Americans rather than Christopher Columbus, who many of them view as not the hero that he has been made out to be. And the council did acknowledge them. Chris Seelbach, Yvette Simpson, they did say, you know, they did recognize that they were there, and they kind of recognized that they may agree with the speakers, but they just said there was no motion on the table. There was nothing they could do, really, and that even if they had something on the table, they probably didn't have the votes to do it anyway. Wendell Young supported the motion last year. This year, he's out sick. He had a major heart injury. And so without him there and without other people flipping their votes, which they didn't seem to think was going to happen, it was just not going to happen. And it was pretty dramatic. The leader of Black Lives Matter, who is also involved in a lot of these other civil rights
issues, Brian Taylor,
okay. he called out each councilman and called him a hypocrite and pointed his finger at them and before leaving the building. And it was pretty dramatic. There were people that were quite upset about it.
So this is twice the issue's come up. Once was official. The second time was unofficial. Did anybody talk about we're going to keep bringing this up till something happens?
Well, I mean, there were some suggestions that there was some encouragement on the part of Chris Seelbach, P.G. Sittenfeld, and Yvette Simpson to ask the public to kind of keep the pressure on. But there wasn't anything that said like, you know, oh, we're going to get it next year or anything like that. There was no suggestion of that, of anything concrete. But, you know, Columbus Day is a Monday if you celebrate it. And that's why it came about this week. Everyone wanted to try to get something done before the day came
about. And did the fact that Cincinnati just recently changed some of its street names back to their original German names, did that play
there was
a part
in
this?
The people who spoke had a lot of praise for council for some of these moves they've made, and they were kind of saying, you know, you guys voted to change the German names of our streets back, you know, the streets back to their German names as kind of a recognition of this German hysteria that happened in World War One, saying that was wrong. This is a way of kind of correcting history. They brought up the push by some members on council to kind of declare Cincinnati a sanctuary city. They brought up a lot of these civil rights proclamations and motions that have been filed on city council. You know, city council motion to support people who were affected by DACA. They've dipped their toe into this water before, and they were kind of pointing out, why aren't you doing it this time?
Cameron, Paula, and Bill, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
WCPO.com politics and government reporter Paula Christian, Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Cameron Knight, and WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. Coming up, lots to see and do as Music Hall reopens this weekend. We'll get a preview of that. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. After 16 months of renovation work, Music Hall reopens this weekend. Cincinnati Public Radio classical music reporter Janelle Gelfand joins us now. And Janelle, welcome to Cincinnati Edition, and welcome to Cincinnati Public Radio, too. We're really glad to have you here.
Thank you, Mark. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So what's new? What were the changes that were made over the past almost year and a half here?
I mean, you could almost say what isn't new. People, when they enter, will be reassured that there is still a lot of the familiar. They'll still see the beautiful proscenium arch, the beautiful balcony fronts, and, of course, the wonderful massive crystal chandelier in the center of Springer Auditorium. But then, as soon as you enter, it is kind of a whole new building. It's been beautifully updated, I must say. I was there again this morning, and coming up from the box office, the first thing I saw was a giant LED screen. Well, you never saw those before. No. So things are changed. It's a cleaner look. You enter the lobby, and I couldn't believe today, as well as every other day that I've been there during the renovation, the light that is streaming in now that those windows and doors have been opened up. The exterior of the building has wonderful black bricks, historic to the building, that were restored and painted in their original patterns that are historic to this high Victorian Gothic revival building. And so then you walk into the main auditorium through a set of light and sound lock doors, and that's new as well. And by the way, if you're late, there is a latecomers lounge. You can go in and watch on a screen there if you're a few minutes late before you're seated. So you enter the auditorium and you're walking down steps, and we've never been had that kind of a slope with steps before. So every floor has been re-sloped, or as they say in the biz, re-raked. And there's a whole new seating configuration. So the hall is now kind of like putting a modern concert hall, like a 21st century hall, into this 19th century building without the historic center aisle that we've all come to know and love. But there are two side aisles, and then it's kind of a sweep of a floor plan. And then in the back is an elevated area, a parterre area. And the seats are very comfortable. I've tried them on all three
floors. They
have cup
holders, don't they?
They have cup holders. Not on every single floor. I think in the gallery there may not be cup holders. But yes, cup holders for the first time. So I guess we're all encouraged to bring our drinks into the auditorium.
And more comfortable, you're saying.
And they are very comfortable. And there's a little more leg room. They're a little wider. And there's more leg room on the main floor than upstairs. So keep that in mind if you're a tall person.
Now, what about the acoustics? How's the sound?
You know, it's going to be interesting. I'm going to hear it for the first time tonight. There have been a couple of acoustic rehearsals, but the media was not invited, so I didn't get to go. Other people heard some of the tweaking of the acoustical, you know, whatever they're doing to tweak the sound. So what you see, what I've seen, are what they have installed in the theater that is new that has to do with acoustics. And those include the fact that there is now a thrust stage. The orchestra is closer to the audience by about 12 feet and in front of the proscenium arch. And the reason for that is because for all these years they've been playing in two acoustical spaces, in front of and behind the arch. And acoustically, everyone, the design team, felt it would be better to be in the same space as the listener. So this should be better for the listener, both in terms of seeing and hearing, as well as for the musicians. And then acoustically, there are new glass and steel acoustical clouds overhead, and they're quite lovely. They are, you know, they kind of deflect and reflect the sound. It's all about sound reflection. And upstairs, it's kind of interesting. They left the third level completely untouched, except for, of course, new paint and chairs. But the original walls are still there, and the original space is still there. Downstairs, the walls have been moved inward. It's a smaller, more intimate theater, but upstairs they kept that as kind of a reverberation chamber, and that's where the sound just kind of, you know, blossoms. And Music Hall is known for its beautiful, warm, it's really a 19th century sound. It's been an all wooden and plaster room until now. The floors are now concrete. The walls have been moved in, and they're made of layered cement board. The acoustician said this will be good for sound. The jury is still out on that.
Okay,
we'll find out. And no, I'm really anxious to hear it. And I know that, you know, they wanted us to hear the best possible situation. And I'm sure they will keep tweaking. In fact, I spoke with Paul Scarborough from Acoustics, which is the consulting acoustician. And he's going to be coming regularly throughout the season and into Cincinnati Opera season to keep tweaking the sound, maybe moving a panel here and there or doing something.
Have you talked to Louis Langre or John Morris Russell about their thoughts on the renovations?
Yeah, well, Louis Langre is very, very pleased. He loves the sound, and he was in in the hall for a couple rehearsals before they went on their big European tour, and he thinks it's a big success. I'm sure that they, like everyone else, will be adjusting, listening, maybe moving players around and so on. And it's all going to be a little bit of a learning curve for a while because it's like a new hall.
So what can we expect this weekend? What kind of events are going on around this?
Oh, Janelle? Boy. Well, of course, if you can get a ticket tonight, there may be a few left. I'm sure there are some tomorrow night. The Cincinnati Symphony is going to open with, you know, great fanfare. It's welcoming back to the hall concert is this weekend, 8 p.m. both nights. And it's going to, of course, open with John Adams' Short Ride in a Fast Machine. And so that should be something really fun to kick off the program. And then tomorrow during the day, there is going to be another ribbon cutting at 9:30 a.m., but the hall is open from 10 until 3, and it will be full of free performances. This is an all-free community open house. It's the best time for everyone in the city to come and see it. You know, it's a hall that belongs to the city. It's not just for people who go to the symphony or the opera or the ballet or the May Festival. And those are the primary tenants, of course. But it's for everyone. And I think we all have fond memories of perhaps you graduated, held your graduation there, or your first date, or there are just so many memories connected with this great iconic building. So all of these things will be going on. It's a perfect time to go see it. And then
there's a lot outside the outside of Music Hall as well.
A lot
there?
Outside. There are events. It's all presented by Arts Wave. You can see the whole lineup on my blog, as well as artswave.org outside. And then down the street, all of the buildings that it's now become an arts district next door to Music Hall, Memorial Hall will be open. You can go in and look at that beautiful renovation. You can walk down the street and see the new Cincinnati Shakespeare Company Theater, which I have not seen yet. And you can walk a block down over Divine Street and see the Ensemble Theater and what they're doing there. So it's going to be a really fun weekend, and the weather should be great, and you'll have fun walking around and just taking it all in.
I think the part of the historical significance of this was that prior to this renovation, it had been, 50 years since any renovation work had been done on Music Hall?
1969, that was J. Ralph and Patricia Corbett who largely underwrote that renovation, and that brought in air conditioning, and of course, the zoo came from, which had been performing at the Cincinnati Zoo, was able to move indoors with air conditioning and escalators and all of those things. One escalator remains. I know there was an outcry when they were going to take out the escalators, but there is one there, and it will change directions after the show.
But now they have elevators, right, going up all of the floors. Right?
Absolutely, also elevators. And for the first time, all three floors, and you can enter at the box office level and get everywhere by elevator.
Janelle, thank you for joining me today.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Cincinnati Public Radio classical music reporter Janelle Gelfand. You can read Janelle's stories on classical music and the arts at wguc.org. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at wvxu.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. Josh Elstro was the technical director, or I should say Dave Shermer was the technical director. And William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney. The power of observation is the ability to not just look at something, but to notice details and interpret them properly. And it's an essential skill in everything from police work to medicine to the arts. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll talk with Amy Herman about how to enhance your visual intelligence. And we'll hear about the LiveWell Collaborative, which is celebrating 10 years as an innovation center. That's Cincinnati Edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.